the person who knows, in this case, is Mark Bradley, who is writing not just a, but the book on the history of our contemporary human rights regime that emerged in and after the Second World War and holds unto the present and hopefully with some transformations will continue into the future. Mark is associate professor of history at the college and he is a PhD from Harvard. He has just published a book in his other specialty, as it were, in Southeast Asian history. He has written a book on making sense of the Vietnam War. A few years back, he edited a volume that was widely and is still widely used on truth claims, representations, and human rights. And he has obviously a long list of honors and awards, which I will not quote here. He will be talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at 60, an effort to make sense of this declaration, where it comes from, what it does, and maybe where it will go to. Okay.
Thank you, Michael. And Tom, thank you for being here. And I know both Susan and Michael and I sort of joined together in thanking you for your support of the Human Rights Program as it's growing and developing on campus. We appreciate that. I guess I should say at the outset that, you know, the congressional record aside, and not wanting to be disloyal at all to the University of Chicago, that as an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, I was taught that, in fact, we, in 1964, had invented the teach-in. So there may be some sort of discrepancies here that have to be cleared up on this matter. What I would like to do to get us started today is to take you back not 60 years, but 59 years ago, give or take several weeks, when more than 3,000 people packed into Carnegie Hall in New York City on the evening of Saturday, December 10th, 1949. And they did this to celebrate both in word and in music the first anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, the crowd that was gathered in Carnegie Hall was largely made up of delegates to the United Nations General Assembly and their guests, although there were also many figures like Eleanor Roosevelt who were seen as playing critical roles in drafting the Declaration itself. An even larger listening public, in fact, heard the event as it was broadcast on the radio and televised live by the National Broadcasting Company. Now, considerable thought, apparently, had gone into what this program would look like to, again, mark the first anniversary of the Declaration. And this thought, in part, was through the efforts of Leonard Bernstein, whom the program had been turned over to. What would the musical program, the Boston Symphony Orchestra playing it, look like for this commemorative event? It would include the premiere of Shostakovich's United Nations March, which you haven't heard, it's a kind of jolly little piece, a Paganini violin concerto with Yehudi Menuhin, and of course, the sort of canonical Beethoven's Ode to Joy choral finale of the Ninth Symphony, one that you would guess might happen at an event like this. Essentially, the United Nations and Bernstein both trying to pull out the stops here. But the program opened with a new work that had been commissioned specifically for the event. Aaron Copland's preamble for A Solemn Occasion, a very short 6-minute piece for both orchestra and narrator. And Copland took as his text for the composition this portion of the 1945 Charter of the United Nations. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrows to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women of all nations, large and small, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. As Sir Laurence Olivier entered the stage in Carnegie Hall, the crowd stood in silence as he read the full preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its much more specific calls for the respect and observance of individual human rights as the common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. The Copeland piece then began, initially in a kind of dissident vein, aimed to evoke apparently the scourge and the sorrows of war, a mood that shifted relatively rapidly in the second section to a much more triumphant sensibility when suddenly the brass and the percussion were more in evidence. And then Laurence Olivier began to narrate the portion of the UN Charter that I've just read, this quietly underlined by a reprise of this opening section, after which the valences of this second section come back to bring the piece to an appropriately affirmative and ringing climax. Now, my hunch is that few of you have ever heard this particular piece by Copeland. It doesn't exactly have the ubiquity of either the Lincoln portrait or the fanfare for the common man, and in fact, Copeland himself dismissed it as something of a potboiler. Well, critics in 1949 were considerably kinder, in fact. It does remain one of Copeland's most obscure works. And as far as I know, it goes unrecorded in its original form to this day. I linger on the Copeland piece and its performance in 1949, both the sweep of the ambitions that it conveyed, but also its subsequent obscurities, as they strike me as a helpful way in to thinking about the problematics of how we ought to commemorate the anniversary of the Universal Declaration today. The musical language of Copeland's preamble and its reception in Carnegie Hall capture a moment in the making of a global human rights order that was, in fact, extraordinary, though one that today only is imperfectly understood. Quite simply, there had never been anything like it before in the global sphere. Not only did the adoption of the UN Charter in 1945 and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 articulate global human rights norms and duties that sought to protect individual civil, political, social, and economic rights, they also set in motion an unprecedented series of regional and transnational rights declarations, covenants, and conventions. In Latin America, for instance, delegates at several Pan-American congresses during World War II itself adopted a regional rights vocabulary that in many ways anticipated the Universal Declaration and would culminate in the adoption of the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man, sometimes known as the Bogota Declaration, in 1948. At the same time, immediately after World War II, Western European states began to draft their own rights lexicon, producing the European Convention on Human Rights in 1950. At the same time that Copeland's preamble was being played in Carnegie Hall, discussions at the United Nations centered on a convention to outlaw genocide, a global freedom of information covenant, renewed attention to the Geneva Convention's protections for the rights of non-combatants in times of war, protective rights of asylum for refugees, and also drafting legally binding guarantees of the political, social, and economic rights outlined in the Universal Declaration. And yet, in the 59 years that followed the celebration of this moment in New York, well, the Universal Declaration may not have fallen into quite the same deep memory hole as Copeland's preamble. It was often seen at the margins of an international order shaped by the Cold War and decolonization, rather than concerns about individual human rights norms that were enshrined in the Declaration itself. It is, for instance, it seems to me, telling that states and people in the Global South remained considerably more focused on collective self-determination in the Cold War-inflected decolonization struggles of the 1950s and the 1960s than they did with individual rights claims in the Universal Declaration. Or that seemingly without irony, the UN's own commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the Universal Declaration in 1968 centered around an international conference on human rights in Tehran, hosted by the Shah of Iran, whose own security forces were beginning their reign of human terror. Or that in the early 1970s, as Democrats in the US Congress became more concerned again with human rights issue, that Congress people needed to staff out a detailed history of the drafting of the Declaration. Who knew, one congressman said in asking for this staff report, that there had been such a fuss about human rights in the 1940s? So the question for me is, how do you think through the history of a document that is both simultaneously without global precedent, and yet one whose norms are not always honored in the breach, as we know, but also whose very existence could be forgotten by some of those who were most responsible for its creation, let alone a wider public? Too often, it seems to me, the Universal Declaration gets caught as a kind of stand-in for more general attitudes about the significance of a global human rights order after 1945. For those of us who are sympathetic to the Universal Declaration, as I would guess most of us in this room today are, the Declaration serves as the generative cornerstone for such a regime. But this has sometimes been articulated in conceptually problematic ways. In one still influential accounting, states and people from ever wider sectors of the globe almost inexorably seem to bring into being ever more capacious articulations of human rights and their protections in the local, national, and transnational spheres. All of this unfolding seemingly in a kind of gradual Whiggish progression toward a soon apparently to be realized Kantian perpetual peace. These views are usually expressed in narratives of the power of individuals, human rights heroes and human rights heroines, most notably Eleanor Roosevelt, who is often given a kind of star turn in the making of the Universal Declaration, that together these heroes and heroines effectively transform the ways in which a variety of local and global actors see the world around them. Now, against these evolutionary and sometimes celebratory narratives, others, of course, have approached the very notion of global human rights with considerably more skepticism. The apparent triumphs of a global human rights regime for these observers are little more than a smokescreen or an illusion, to channel back to Jeremy Bentham, nonsense on stilts. Nor, they argue, should the apparent embrace of rights talk in such normative statements as the Universal Declaration obscure the ways in which the more fundamental exercise and hierarchy of power within and between states and societies remains largely unchanged in its wake. If individuals matter in this view, and quite often, to be honest, individuals don't, the operative names would probably tend to be Pinochet, Pol Pot, Brezhnev, Kissinger, or George Bush, rather than Eleanor Roosevelt or Andrei Sakharov. In its sort of strongest realist iteration, the voluntarist ethos of the Universal Declaration is simply no match for power politics. Now, other skeptics focus on how talk of universal human rights obscures its genealogies in Western imperialism and in a kind of heterosocial patriarchy. Here, the Universal Declaration is sometimes rendered as emblematic of how a particular set of hegemonic European-American norms have come unfairly, in this view, to structure the global rights order. Now, each of these approaches, things are getting better, things are getting worse, there are contradictions and paradoxes here, each of these approaches to the Universal Declaration and the broader problem of understanding the emergence of a global human rights order after 1945 do important interpretive work, and I want to emphasize that. Accounts that center on the rise of local and global human rights movements have recovered a set of people, ideas, and processes that had been marginalized or ignored in most histories of the post-1945 period. And if realist accounts may too quickly remarginalize or dismiss these developments, they nonetheless remind us of the contested ground upon which human rights norms stand and the enduring forces that contribute to their very uneven realization in practice. Similarly, the attention to Euro-American dimensions of the global human rights imagination directly foreground the ways in which power and culture inform patterns of alterity that have shaped some of the contours of both human rights talk and practice since 1945. It is men, not women, whites, not persons of color, straights, not gays, citizens in the metropole, not colonized peoples or stateless peoples, who were and can still be privileged in various iterations of global human rights norms. But it does seem to me that there are dangers of collapsing our understanding of the Universal Declaration and its legacies into these analytical categories. Most importantly, because they allied the question of why the global articulation of individual human rights norms came to be believable, not only through the making of the Universal Declaration in the late 1940s, but also how those sensibilities have lingered for a variety of states and non-state actors in the now almost 60 years since the Declaration was ratified by the UN's General Assembly. Now, to step back from these sort of larger categories of analysis about human rights politics, we need to be willing to put aside not only some of the realist and culturalist theoretical skepticism about the very project of human rights, but I think we also need to put aside the notion of linear progress that has infused more celebratory accounts of global human rights practices. Instead, it seems to me that a more useful way to concentrate, as in fact Lynn Hunt has urged in her study of what she terms the 18th century rights revolution, is on moments of jumps and disjunctures, jumps and discontinuities, in which global rights talk in the post-1945 period in fact did come to be believable in a range of geographic, cultural, and gendered contexts, offering what transnational publics and some state actors saw as a powerful language for more fully realizing human dignity and welfare in a space that transcended both the local and the national. Now, the normative creation of the late 1940s that brought the Universal Declaration and global human rights norms into being, it seems to me, is one of those moments of jumps and discontinuities. But its larger global significance can be obscured in accounts that have placed people like Eleanor Roosevelt and Euro-American rights concerns at the center of the story. As historians who have studied the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Rights in detail argue, it was very much a universal undertaking. Latin American states, in particular, were absolutely critical to the very far-reaching guarantees of social and economic rights that emerge in the Universal Declaration. These are Articles 22 to 27. Susan, we should have had a little booklet that we could have handed out with the Declaration. These are, and again, surprising, I think, maybe more from an American context than a wider world context, rights to Social Security, rights to equal work and pay, rights to adequate standards of living and education, and rights to social protection for children. There was a particular Chilean lawyer who was very active in the drafting process for the Universal Declaration, but again, it wasn't just about this figure in particular. There was a larger, if diffuse, Latin American rights sensibility that had been shaped by long-standing engagement with continental philosophical traditions, strains of Catholic and socialist thought, and also these wartime regional deliberations over the Bogota Human Rights Declaration, all of which hovered over their broad and intense role in not only the drafting of the Declaration, this during 1946 and 1948, but also in the long formal debates that unfolded over as many as 85 sessions of the General Assembly's Third Committee in the fall of 1948 as the final declaration sorted itself out. Women from non-Western states like India, the Dominican Republic, and Pakistan as well as smaller Western states like Denmark, were also engaged in many processes in terms of the drafting of the Declaration. In particular, a woman from India, Hansa Mehta, was especially vocal, sometimes, in fact, to the serious displeasure of, and I don't know how to characterize this, a paternal Eleanor Roosevelt, a maternal Eleanor Roosevelt, but at any rate, she wasn't always wild about Hansa Mehta's interventions into the language of the Declaration. But in fact, she was critical in ensuring that Article 1 of the Declaration read, "All human beings," rather than "All men are born free and equal to dignity and rights." Eleanor Roosevelt thought you could just let it go. Now, all of this helps to account, I think, for the kind of virtual unanimity that Michael was mentioning within the UN when the final draft of the Declaration came up for a vote. We'll bracket the Soviet Union and its allies for just a moment here. And I think it does, in real ways, speak to the very on-the-ground universal character of the document, even in its construction. But at the same time, it's also important to appreciate the broader contours of the moment in which this drafting process was happening, and also when the Declaration, in effect, had been approved. Of the global environment, really, from which the Declaration and the UN Charter's human rights provisions that, in fact, had enabled its creation emerged. The post-war moment, from my perspective at least, was a very liminal one. The Cold War was yet to come, a still unanticipated contingency, at least in its global scope. Rather, a lingering spirit of wartime internationalism, whether it be for collective security at the United Nations or international economic cooperation through the Bretton Woods system, continued to inflect the ways in which many envisioned how post-war international order would go. Now, there were, of course, many tensions within this internationalist vision. And for human rights questions, one of them, and perhaps the most important of them, centered on the reach of global protections for individual human rights and the more traditional bounds of state sovereignty. How far could global norms intrude, essentially, into what were thought of as sovereign domestic spaces? Now, the UN Charter itself appeared to offer somewhat contradictory responses to that question. On the one hand, the preamble of the Charter pledged member states to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms for all. Articles 55 and 56 of the Charter spell out in more detail exactly what those would be, and also set up something of an embryonic mechanism within the UN for dealing with human rights issues. On the other hand, as many of you know, the Charter also contains Article 2.7 that promises, quote, "Nothing in the Charter should authorize intervention into matters that are essentially within the domestic jurisdictions of any state." So the question is, how do we think about these contradictions at the moment? And one influential reading has been to suggest that even at the moment of creation, for the global human rights order, that essentially sovereignty had already trumped global rights. A view that maps on to this more dismissive notion that I had discussed just a bit earlier about a kind of skepticism to the global human rights order more generally. Those who make this argument in the context of the moment of the 1940s usually point to the fact that both the Universal Declaration and the Charter promote and encourage respect for human rights. They don't, however, protect them. But at least some contemporary observers in the late 1940s saw the situation and these contradictions very differently. For them, the relationship between an emergent global human rights order outlined in the Charter and the Universal Declaration, particularly its insistence that member states do, in fact, respect the individual rights of all of their citizens, and the domestic jurisdiction clause of the Charter remained much more open and porous in their minds. The articulation of global rights norms, again, both in the Charter and the Universal Declaration, appeared to these observers to at least offer the possibility of rethinking the bounds of sovereignty and the relationships between individuals, states, and the transnational over rights questions. These conditions of possibility in the moment of the Universal Declaration emerge not in some kind of distant or elite transnational space, but again, were very much an on-the-ground phenomena. For example, a series of cases made their way through American courts in the late 1940s and early 1950s, all of which employed, for the time, the novel legal argument that the controlling power of international human rights norms across national boundaries, both in the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration, in fact trumped domestic law and claims of national sovereignty over rights claims. So completely reversing, in a sense, what people had thought of as the traditional way these questions would go. These cases were brought by Japanese American, African American, and Native American plaintiffs, and they used, all of them, a transnational frame to approach a variety of instances of domestic racial discrimination in the United States, in housing, in land and fishing rights, in public accommodation, and also in education. Let me give you, very briefly, just one illustrative case. This was Rice versus Sioux City Memorial Cemetery, a case that emerged in 1953, so sort of at the tail end of the kind of Universal Declaration moment. It emerged, more particularly, however, in the wake of the death of Sergeant John Rice in the Korean War. Rice's widow had entered into a contract with the Sioux City Cemetery for his burial. And at the graveside services, several officials from the cemetery noted that there were a number of Native American mourners in the crowd and began to wonder to themselves, in fact, was Sergeant John Rice Native American? So they visited Rice's widow, who told them that, in fact, their assumptions were correct. The cemetery, which had a Caucasians-only burial policy that didn't seem particularly sensitive to issues of Korean War heroism, ordered that her body, or that her husband's body, be immediately removed from the cemetery. Now, the action drew immediate and quite national attention, and in fact prompted President Truman to intervene. He arranges for Rice to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. But not placated by this symbolic gesture on Truman's part, Rice's widow, who was a very feisty person, sued in Iowa court, and she sued in part on global human rights grounds. And when the Iowa Supreme Court dismissed her case, she took it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in the brief for that case to the Supreme Court, Rice and her lawyers dealt at some length on charter-inspired human rights provisions, arguing essentially that the Iowa court had violated, quote, the basic and very fundamental concepts of equality, not only announced but also pledged by the United Nations Charter and all the member nations of which the United States is one. Again, the Rice case, one of many in this period of time, making similar claims. And in this liminal post-war moment, when articulations of rights and sovereignty were both in play at the intersection of the domestic and the transnational, the petitioners in these American global rights cases, and also the judges that heard these petitions favorably, essentially are acting to harness the potentialities of an international human rights set of guarantees, and also a kind of more relaxed sensibility about sovereignty to combat domestic racial discrimination in the United States. For them, the Universal Declaration was in fact believable. It would, for instance, allow a California court in one of these cases, a Japanese land right case, to argue in a 1950 opinion, quote, discrimination against a people of one race is contrary to both the letter and to the spirit of the UN Charter, which as a treaty is paramount to every law of every state in conflict with it. California law must therefore yield to the treaty as the superior authority. Now, this California court provided perhaps the most muscular assertion of the domestic reach of global human rights norms in an American context, but nonetheless, there were a substantial number of state and federal courts, and in one case, several Supreme Court justices, who proved receptive to these claims. Their responses, it seems to me, reveal the kind of horizons of possibility in the late 1940s for articulating looser constructions of state sovereignty in cases of violations of human rights. From a willingness to grant moral, if not necessarily legal, authority to transnational rights guarantees, to a more fuller embrace of the controlling power, both of the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration for domestic law. Now, these conditions of possibility that were opened up by the moment of the Universal Declaration in the late 1940s were largely closed down by the mid-1950s. And Jim Sparrow will discuss, I think, some of the particulars of that retreat in the American context in our second hour. But more broadly speaking, the ways in which the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union came to structure international order and domestic politics, and also the preoccupation of decolonizing states with collective self-determination, tended to push the Universal Declaration's global vocabularies of individual rather than collective human rights off center stage throughout most of the 1950s and the 1960s. But again, in the kind of jumps and discontinuities that seems to me shape the unfolding of a post-1945 rights order, the norms of the Universal Declaration became believable again. And in some ways, they became believable again with a vengeance in the 1970s. You see this in the fluorescence of Amnesty International and its Nobel Prize in 1977, in claims for political and civil rights among dissidents in the Soviet Union, in the Helsinki Accords, in the Charter 77 movement in Czechoslovakia and the larger sensibility of it in Eastern Europe, in an international women's conference in Mexico City in 1975, in transnational campaigns against human rights abuses in Latin America and also against apartheid in South Africa, and in the 1970s in renewed attention to socioeconomic rights and to the problems of transnational migrants, just to name a few. All products of this new moment of believability. One, it seems to me, whose sensibilities in certain ways linger on into the present moment. Now, in this moment, global human rights politics increasingly shifted focus from state-dominated construction of norms to transnational advocacy and enforcement of them by non-state and juridical actors. The rapid proliferation of non-governmental human rights organizations, they increased tenfold between 1961 and 1984 to about 12,000, was one critical element of this move toward transnational advocacy. And beginning in the 1980s, new transnational juridical bodies, such as regional courts or international tribunals, as well increasingly as the novel use of domestic courts, begin to provide individual victims of human rights abuses with redress and compensation. Now, celebration isn't exactly the lexicon of academic protocol at the University of Chicago. We interrogate, we unpack, we sometimes tear things apart, but we seldom out and out celebrate. And yet, to apprehend the multiple meanings of the Universal Declaration over the last 60 years, I think requires that in fact we do some celebrating, albeit perhaps with a more critical eye to particularities and context, to these jumps and discontinuities. In that spirit, let me offer one last story in an effort both to concretize this second global human rights movement of believability in the late 20th century, but also the larger meanings that we might accord to the Universal Declaration today. On the 29th of March, 1976, 17-year-old Jolita Filartiga was tortured to death by the Inspector General of Police in the capital city of Paraguay, a man by the name of America Peño Herrala. Jolita was the son of Joel Filartiga, a doctor and longstanding opponent of the Stroessner regime that had dictatorially ruled Paraguay since 1954. Later that day, after the torture had taken place, the police brought Filartiga's daughter to Peña's home and showed her his severely tortured body. She fled the house, horrified. Joel Filatiga unsuccessfully sought redress against Peña and the police in Paraguayan courts for the torture and the murder of his son. In doing this, his attorney was arrested, brought to police headquarters, shackled to the wall, and threatened by Peña with death. Several years later, Filatiga and his daughter came to the United States seeking permanent political asylum. And when they learned that Peña was also in the United States and living, in fact, in Brooklyn, they filed a complaint in U.S. District Court against him, claiming that Peña had wrongfully caused Jolita's death by torture. The complaint rested on something called the Alien Tort Statute, which established U.S. federal court jurisdiction over, quote, all causes where an alien sues for a tort committed in violation of the law of nations. The legal strategy was a really bold one. The Alien Tort Statute, which is a part of the Judiciary Act of 1789, had rarely been invoked in any American court since 1789, and never before on questions dealing with human rights. Lawyers for the Filatigas argued that official torture violated an emerging norm of customary international law, in part brought into being by Article 5 of the Universal Declaration, which prohibited torture, triggering, they argued, the applicability of the statute for their case against Peña. The district court dismissed the complaint. But in a sweeping June 1980 opinion, the U.S. Court of Appeals held that deliberate official torture did violate universally accepted norms of human rights law, and that under the Alien Tort Statute, an alien could bring an alleged torturer before federal court for actions committed outside the border of the United States. The Filatiga decision was, in many ways, like the Universal Declaration, a remarkable one, foreshadowing and accelerating a variety of moves after 1980, among them efforts to try the Chilean General Pinochet in Spain, the emergence of international tribunals in The Hague, Rwanda, and Sierra Leone, and in fact the establishment of the International Criminal Court more recently, all aimed at global accountability in cases of torture and other gross violations of human rights. In all these senses, Filatiga illustrates the revolutionary reach of human rights norms in and across the boundaries of states that were first set in motion by the framers of the Universal Declaration. But it also reveals some of the problems that shape and constrain how we apprehend the meanings of human rights and the legacies of the Declaration. The presiding judge in this case closed his opinion in this way. Quote, in the 20th century, the international community has come to recognize the common danger posed by the flagrant disregard of human rights. The torturer has become, like the pirate or the slave trader before him, an enemy of mankind. Now many, if not most, who read the judge's opinion, myself included, are likely to agree. In a normative sense, for most people, it is unthinkable to enslave or to torture another person. But of course, in practice, it isn't. Before and after Filatiga, just as before and after the abolition of slavery, human rights norms and beliefs didn't necessarily govern practice. The unthinkable persists, most recently and dramatically in American prisons in Iraq and Cuba, but also in a variety of other violations of political, economic, sexual, social, and cultural rights in this country and in the rest of the world. But the Filatiga case also helps us understand how the broader sensibilities of the Universal Declaration have come to make the suffering of strangers matter as much as one's own. And as they do, and perhaps because they do, no matter how contingent and situated the discourse of human rights has been in historical time, and however detached we ought to be from either celebratory or dismissive narratives of its unfolding, the history of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its meanings over the last 60 years has, in fact, produced a believability in the world-shattering power of human rights. If chastened by the ambiguities, the contradictions, and the failures of the past, in the end, it seems to me, it's the right to hope that drives us forward. Thanks.